The most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay.
May Pang is this week's guest on Turning Point with Frank McKay. May Pang is an author of the book My Lost Weekend with Lennon and is best known as the girlfriend of legendary Beatles band member John Lennon. In her interview with Frank, she discusses the famous Lost Weekend and the controversy surrounding the Phil Spector studio shooting. Let's listen.
And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point. Our very special guest today is May Pang, from the world of the music industry and certainly the historical Beatles. And May, I'm sure, will have insight into, you know, both those subjects. May, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. And how are you? I'm glad to be on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What are you keeping busy with nowadays?
I'm finally over the hump on the fact of, you know, the kids are older. For a long time, I've been staying home, being that at-home mom, taking care of the kids. They were, you know, they're one is out of college, one is still in college, but I could actually leave the house and not have to worry that I have to be home to get them off the bus.
Yeah. May, what was Alan like? You hear mixed stories and mixed reviews about his personality. How was he to work with directly?
His persona was so big. It scared the living daylights out of him because, you know, you hear about him, but you don't know about him. But in the end, a lot of the stuff you hear, that was his business. But what they didn't hear and what they didn't know was he had a side that was very, he was very smart. And there was a side about him that he used to, you know, those charities, he would donate. There were people that if they needed the money for their health. Like there was a person that we knew that had to have a bypass, but he had no money, typical of the, you know, from the 60s, 70s, no one saved anything. He just said, just have them send the bill to me. I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
That's the side that nobody ever hears about. He was always there for any of the charity. He would buy a table. If there was an auction, he would buy the items, and he would just, you know, the money would go back to something.
Well, here's a two-parter. The first part is, from what year to what year did you work with Alan Klein? And then when was the last time you saw Alan Klein?
I worked there from 1969, 71, 72. Because then I switched over and really was working directly for John and Yoko. Because it came in the crossroads. I was really working for Alan and working in publishing, and then they would loan me out to do some of the stuff with John and Yoko, and then they would keep asking, and then they came back on a more permanent basis, and they said, you're at the crossroad, where do you want to work? Of course, so, you know, because John and Yoko wanted me as well as the office, so I had to figure out which way I was going. So I went with John and Yoko because I loved being in the recording studio, and it was great. I had it just took me to another level. When the last time I saw Alan, I would probably say in early 2002.
And for the listeners' sake, we're talking about Alan Klein. He was, you know, after Brian Epstein's death, he had taken over the, really, what it was a debacle, the Apple situation.
Well, everybody thinks that, but he, you know, yeah, because the boys needed direction, and after Epstein, everybody went in different directions. John, George, and Ringo went with Alan, and Paul once stayed with his father-in-law. And so the management of the individuals went differently. Alan, you know, a lot of people didn't realize in the early days, Alan, when he went back to negotiate contracts, for instance, like for the Beatles, after the EMI Capitol record deal was over, he went back and he negotiated. And part of it was he did something that nobody else did, because in the early days they used to say, we want, you know, the record company say, I would want 10% of any of the breakage of records from the artist, you know. And Alan just stood there and apparently said, what? Breakage. He would take a 45, because by that point the material was different. There's, breakage was not really, you know, an issue anymore. He threw it on the floor and, you know, he said, there's no breakage. Because it would just land there. And he goes, and so it was taken out of the contract. And from that moment, almost every other contract from every artist, that came out of. So he started certain things. He was bold in his way of doing things.
In your work-a-day situation with mm-hmm. ABCO, did you have any need to work with George Martin or deal with him?
No, I did not.
And what what was your actual title over there? Were you were the assistant to?
Well, in the beginning, it was just being a person that in the royalties department, because I would log in my royalties for all the different artists. But as time went on, I was actually in the music publishing division, cataloging, issuing mechanical license for the songs and everything. So, which I enjoyed, because then I got a chance to know who was actually recording what songs when we were issuing license. I mean, it's great when you see Frank Sinatra saying, I'm doing something, or this person is going to be doing that song, or any of the Rod Stewart doing a Sam Cooke, song. It was just interesting, and seeing all the people, and in between, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I did not see coming in, but they were around. You just knew they were around.
Now, was this did this start out as an internship, or was this a straight job, straight paying job immediately?
Straight paying job.
Straight paying.
I found it was like being at the right place at the right time, and it was really very, very interesting.
Would you share your original salary with us, or is that something you keep private?
Oh, my original salary in those days, how about $90 a week?
Wow.
So it's not a lot of money.
It's certainly different, different times also.
Yeah.
And did you live at home?
I did. And if it wasn't for living at home, I don't think I would have been able to make anything work.
Yeah.
So it didn't. At $90, I mean, it sounds very small. You're right. It was a decent salary for a person who didn't have a lot of experience in the working world. That was my first job, my real first job.
Listen, let's face it. If you want to work in the music business and you want to work in something you love, you're gonna have to start out small.
Exactly, and I don't think that a lot of people in this day and age understand that.
Yeah, well,
I think a lot of people just want a lot of money immediately, and it doesn't work that way. You really have to. It's really working from the ground up.
No question about that.
You understand that, and it's just because I've worked a long time, and a lot of people don't realize I actually did work before meeting all these people. This is not, but it was a dream to be working in the field that I wanted to work in.
Now
that's the difference.
Let's transition to working for ABCO, and then working for John and Yoko directly.
Mm-hmm.
How did that occur?
Well, they came in while I was still working, obviously, at ABCO. They came in, and they wanted to make, in late 70, in December of 70, they wanted to come in and make a couple of films. And they needed people in the office to work. And so a lot of people knew I would be the perfect person. So I ended up being volunteered out to them while they were in town to make two films, which were they were Yoko's films. They were called Up Your Legs Forever, mm-hmm. Which was about 365 pairs of legs donated for peace, as it were, for her film. And the other one was called Fly, which was about watching, following a fly crawling all over a nude woman's body. Yes.
Yeah.
So you...
Mainstream going, stuff. Real mainstream, yeah.
Yeah. So I was just sort of taken aback and going, okay. And, it was just out of the ordinary. And to me, I racked it up as experience of doing something.
Yeah. Were you involved in the filmmaking?
I was involved in making sure, just being a gopher for anything, or being their assistant if they needed to go get something, whether it be food, whether it be to deliver or get an equipment or something, anything. So it was on that level. There was a few of us, but I was one of them. I was one wish for the Up Your Legs Forever. Yoko came over and she says, here's my phone book. I want you to call everybody in this phone book and tell them you're my assistant and that you want them to come down and donate their legs for peace.
Mm.
And I'm looking at this phone book And I'm looking, I'm having to call Andy Warhol, you know, Osamu Noguchi. I'm talking about famous names. And you
sure.
Go, oh, my God. And I'm going to be calling these people. You know, so it was just one of those.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
What was their reaction? I mean, and I don't mean each individual reaction, but in general, was it like, oh, God, here's Yoko calling me up about some stupid movie? Or was it all great? I'd love to help out John and Yoko.
It was a mixture. It was like some of them were in town. Some of them were going, tell her thank you, but I'm busy.
Yeah.
You know, or some of them going, what does she mean that she wants to have our legs donated for peace? So, you know, you have to go into that. So it was a mixture.
Yeah, she's become, the actual antithesis of, well, I should say she's become the icon figure of a person getting involved in a project from the outside and really causing interference.
Right.
Is that fair from your experience with them?
You know, she had her ways, and she fought to have her ways be known. And you know, it was not always the best way, and it wasn't, you know, it was annoying, and it was she just wanted to show, you know, I can do it, and that was her way of doing things.
Yeah,
and you know, John used to have to be the spokesperson, and you know, when John and I were together, he used to say to me, the best person to really be her advocate was not himself, but who understood her work better was her other husband, her other ex-husband, Anthony Cox.
Hmm. Did you get closer to Yoko at first, or John?
You know, I worked more with Yoko than John. John was always in the background. He would come through, but he really did not. It was more Yoko. And I, you know, she was running the show more in the sense of, cause she had more projects. But when he got on board for his albums or his stuff, you knew it.
Yeah.
You just knew it. So he would take his time, but Yoko had, we had daily things. I dealt with both of them on a daily basis.
Let me ask you the same question I asked about Alan Klein. Did John ever say to you, hey, look, just tolerate her with this? And, you know, was there any of that? Or was it, do you think he was a true believer in Yoko? Obviously,
he was to his certain extent, absolutely. I think the one thing he was always, he was good about, and he was very easy he was actually easy to work with because he understood everybody. And I remember I was working like 16-hour days at one point. And he would say, Yoko, you got to stop. You got to give everybody a breather. They're going to be hauling you out of here, you know?
Yeah.
He was more conscious of things that were around the surroundings than Yoko.
And again, you know, at the risk of getting salacious or, you know, anything, I certainly don't want to, you know, get, you know, tread too much on there. But the Two Virgins cover, right, that had the two of them naked, full frontal nudity of Yoko and John, and it would give the impression, and it, you know, even you mentioned the fly, right? It's a fly dancing mm-hmm. on the, you know, from spot to spot on a nude woman's body. Were the two of them, you know, active participants in, you know, I mean, what people would, I guess, generalize as orgies, experimental sex?
Your guess is as good as mine. I was not a participant in any of these type of things, so I have no idea.
Right, but as far as you know, I mean, you must have heard from different areas that, you know, that there's, you know, there's things going on, wild parties, or even, you know, films, you know, film experiments. What would you consider them to be, you know, just pure artists, and they're doing this for the artistic, or was it sexual in nature? What's your guess?
I think, you know what, I really don't know, because when it came to the fly thing, I didn't have any clue until I showed up
yeah.
to the set that this was all going on. And I found it very interesting. I mean, these were Yoko films. And I don't know anything beyond that. I mean, this is to tell you how naive I was at the time. I remember seeing her, the woman laying out and this fly crawling, and I'm thinking, how could she lay so still? Not thinking that later on I found out I think she took some sleeping pill and was out for the count. You know, so I had no idea.
And how long would a film like, you know, I don't want to get into the fly here, but the how long was a film like that? How long a film was it?
Well, I think originally when it was first edited, I think it took, she showed it at one of the Avant-Garde Film Festival, right, it took 3 weeks. I mean, all this took 3 weeks. The two films, shooting it, editing, and then showing it at the end of 3 weeks. And I think that film originally was 45 minutes, and it got cut down to about 20 minutes later on.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking that, to me, it was just a little too long for me anyway. I mean, watching a fly.
Sure.
There's only so much you could do.
No, I hear you. And again, I'm trying very hard not to poke fun at the avant-garde, because obviously it's, you know, art is art, and it's the eye of the beholder and so forth.
Exactly.
But Andy Warhol, it certainly reminiscent of something that Andy Warhol may do. Have you been witness to any interaction between Andy Warhol and Yoko Ono?
I mean, I've seen them together in at parties, but nothing, you know, no real interaction except glad you could be here type of thing, and I'm glad to see you. Nothing more than that.
Do you think Andy Warhol was an influence on Yoko, or maybe the other way around? I can't imagine it was the other way around.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think Yoko is Yoko.
Right, right.
I mean, because, you know, a lot of things that she's doing today is what she did back then. Not much of it is different from you know, her things back then.
In the
that
book
she was involved in.
In jumping ahead for a bit here, and you know, we're skipping quite a bit here, but in the book, He's a Rebel. Did you read it?
No.
It's about Phil Spector. And the famous story. And it was well documented in the book. I don't know how true. Again, you were there during this, and it was during the recording of Rock and Roll.
Yes, in fact, I was the first one to ever put it out in my book.
Yeah.
In my original book, I mentioned it.
All right. Well,
in my book.
You know, I won't ask you. I won't tell you about it. You tell me about it.
No, it was a recording of Rock and Roll. We were working on a song. And they had just finished recording it. And all the musicians, including Phil's mother, was at this recording session.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, we hear a pop. And everybody sort of like did one of those ducking routine. And I looked around, and I'm standing up, the typical New York girl, because this is out in Los Angeles. And I run towards the sound, as opposed to everybody's running away from the sound. And I opened up the lounge. The lounge was attached to the recording studio. And there I see John with his finger in his ear, like going, whoa, what's the sound that just happened? And Phil with the gun in his hand. And Mal Evans, who most people in the Beatle world would know was their roadie. Now you got pictures.
He was a bodyguard, too.
Yeah, bodyguard, everything. He was the roadie. He was everything for the boys. Came from Liverpool. He was like a big giant teddy bear, really. And he, and I see him, and there's John going, Phil, don't mess with my ears. You know, I need them. He said it a little bit more, you know, a little more
aggressively.
Yeah, aggressively, but saying like, hey, you know, I need this, and the colorful words he was using, like, and I'm standing there, and he comes over and he grabs the gun out of Phil's hand. Now, like I said, he's 6'4". Phil's what, 5 foot
nothing,
two,
right?
4, yeah. Whatever. So you can see the height difference. And he goes, "Give me that. You don't deserve to hold that. You know, you shouldn't be holding that." And Phil's going, "You can't tell me what to do." You know, and he goes, and this went on, and I come in and I'm like, I'm going, "What just happened?" And he goes, Mel says, you know, he, you know, we were just horsing around, and I just asked Phil to stop horsing around because whatever he was doing, he was apparently hitting Mal in the nose that it hurt. And so all he did was ask, you know, Phil to, like, stop that. And Phil apparently says, you can't tell me what to do. And as he's pulling the gun out of the holster, it goes up and it goes off.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
And again, we're talking about Phil Spector. We're talking to May Pang. And May, you're an eyewitness to this. What was Phil's mother doing during this?
She was in the other room. We were all listening to the recording session.
So did she see the scene?
Everybody started to come into the room afterwards. And then it's a small room, so everybody was like... And then, of course, you know, John and I are thinking this gun is not loaded. It's probably filled with blanks, because John and I couldn't believe in a million years that he would have a real bullet in there. So I just turned around and I looked at everybody. I said, is everybody calm down? They go, yeah, yeah. I said, okay, let's go back and continue to work. That's how we ended it. You know, it was just like, let's go back to work.
Now, when John reacted and he cursed at Phil, like, you know, I need my ears.
Yeah.
Was there anger? Was it just pure anger? Or was he scared? Were people taking Phil Spector seriously, that he could actually hurt somebody with this gun?
It was more of an annoyance because, like I said, John thought, this is a blank. This don't. It's like shooting those pop caps, you know, when you were a kid,
yeah.
You know, those kid, and, you know, you're doing it, and it's like a kid, you're telling him not to do it, and he's doing it, and you're going, can you stop it already? You know, it's like
your attitude towards it was the same thing. You weren't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we didn't think anything more than what it is, and it wasn't until the next day that Mal came over. He goes, well, here's the bullet from last night. He went to look for us. And John and I said, what bullet? Because in our mind, we never thought in a million years.
That it was a real gun.
That it was a real gun.
And then he kept those tapes. And if the author, and he's the rebel, and I'm sorry, I can't think of the gentleman's name, but it was a wonderful book. As he had put it, Phil Spector, you know, took the tapes, took the, I guess, 2-inch, 24-track
tapes.
Yes, we
didn't know that either.
And he had run up.
Here I've been, because I was, you know, as the production assistant to this whole thing, the production coordinator for the album, it was hard to work with Phil because Phil wouldn't tell anybody anything. So John only wanted, one of the things that we ended up doing when we were doing this, we had just come off of the Mind Games album, and John says, I'm raring to go, but I want to do an album and pay homage to a lot of the songwriters and singers that, you know, that influenced me, you know, the songs that influenced me. I said, great. He goes, we're out in L.A. He goes, let me just get Phil. What a perfect, you know, match. He's worked with Phil before, and it would be the perfect match. And he turned around and he said to Phil, listen, I just want you to be the producer. I don't want to have any of the headaches. I just want to be a singer in the band. Mm. And that was what went on. And we had rehearsals. And, you know, who would have thought, you know, he was always wearing his guns. And I'm thinking, John, I kept saying it. Do you think they're real? You know, that's because none of us have ever seen him do this before. So none of us, we're on his territory now. We're in L.A. He's always in New York when I saw him.
Yeah, it's fact. We could actually do a whole interview on that session, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He never told us who was showing up. And he kept saying, John, you're really giving me the ownership to this, you know, the producership. He goes, absolutely, 100%. I just want to be a singer in the band. And so it was really Phil Spector's session that went nuts. Not so much it was a John, because at a John session, so people would understand the difference, on that album, on that rock and roll album, you could hear the definitive difference in the way it sounded from the wall of sound produced by Phil and the way John produced. Because Stand By Me is on there, and Stand By Me is just crystal clear, sharp. And then when you hear the other songs, they're a little off.
Hmm.
But that's the way Phil had it as opposed to the way John had it. Because John... He didn't have liquor in his. He would ask everybody to be very mindful. When he wanted his sessions, when John was the producer, he would want those sessions straight up, because he would tell people, because could everybody refrain from doing whatever they're doing until after the session, because it's hard enough to learn a song straight, you know, so let's not enhance this. And everybody, everybody respected that, John.
We're speaking with May Pang, and we're talking about the late, great John Lennon and May's experience around the music industry, and certainly the Beatles, and well, the Beatles in their solo efforts. Let's fill in the gap, if you don't mind, between you first starting to work with John and Yoko to really becoming John's not only assistant but his lover.
Yes.
Are you comfortable talking about that?
Yeah, I'm. You know, I was there. I started working for them in December of 70. And then I, on and off, worked for them until the middle of 71, where I ended up really working more for them. So from the office, I ended up starting to work. I started to go to, I went to England. I went and worked over there with them, came back, worked over here in 71. So I started working, like I said, more permanently by mid to fall of 71. And in 71, 72... 73, I moved them into the Dakota. There was, you know, so I worked up there. Moving them in was quite interesting. I'll never forget Yoko saying to me when I first walked into the Dakota, because I had no idea what this building was about. And I walked in, I was, it was amazing. It was an amazing apartment, which she still has to this day. And it once belonged, they were renting it at the time. They didn't own it. And they were renting it from the actor Robert Ryan.
Hmm.
That's who owned the apartment. And so it was a gorgeous place. So, and then somewhere mid 73, they were having problems in their marriage. And I'll never forget when Yoko called me. I was in my office, and she just came in the morning, and she said, "That guy just talked to you." And I'm going, "Okay." And I, you know, having your pad and pencil ready to write your notes and everything. And she says, "You know, just want you to know, you know, John and I are not getting along." And I said, "I'm sorry to hear." Meanwhile, if you've been working in a house or whatever, anybody that was working there, everybody knew that there were, it wasn't a smooth household at that point. It was awkward.
Is this before the quote unquote lost weekend with Harry Nilsson?
Yeah. Yes. The only reason that phrase came in was because people kept asking him about him and Harry so much that he just said, it's easy to just say, it was a lost weekend.
Okay.
So that's how that phrase got coined for us.
Certainly, I don't want to distract you from where you were. You were getting into the conversation between you and Yoko, which really was, you know,
well,
historic
Yoko
at this point.
It was that she wanted somebody to go out with him, and I said I wasn't interested. She goes, "Oh, I know you're not interested." And I wasn't. I worked there already for like 3 years with them. So the last thing I was thinking about is, you know, being somebody's, especially with them.
Mistress.
It was not even in my thoughts.
Yeah.
Far from it. I was looking forward to always go home every night so I can relax. There were days I was working 7 days a week. So you're not looking at them. You don't look at them as, "Oh, John Lennon," you know, because that was person you work with, and I had great relationship with both of them there. So when she came to say that to me, I just looked at her and said, "I'm not interested." She goes, "Oh, I know you're not, but I think you need a boyfriend. I think you need to go out with somebody." And I'm looking at her like, "Are you nuts? I don't want anybody, please. I could do this on my own."
Just to clarify, she was asking you basically to sleep with her husband, right?
She was asking me to go out with him.
Be a companion,
because in actual, what people don't realize in those days, she was actually interested in someone else as well.
Yeah, and who was
which I knew, yeah. And you know, I just sort of sat back and I said, "Wait a minute, where did I get thrown into this?"
So, how soon between that conversation and you becoming a lover to John Lennon?
Oh no, it was because I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like I wasn't interested. And so they were trying, you know, she was trying every which way, and I was like, "Not interested. Don't even go there."
Was she suggesting this because she trusted you? She knew that you weren't interested in him
I think that that was the reason. I mean, I'm only doing it in hindsight. I don't know her actual motive. But I think that that was the reason because I wasn't interested. Because anybody I know that was working for us, that was interested or got too friendly, were no longer there.
Do you think the fact that you're Asian American and the fact that he was in love with this Asian woman, obviously, you know, Yoko, do you think that that had any bearing on her, I want to say, decision to ask you this or her suggestion?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so because, you know, I had been there for 3 years already, and it didn't really, I don't think it mattered. I mean, I always remember John always saying the woman that you know, you always have a fantasy about a male, you know, whether most people would think it's somewhere between the Brad Pitts and the Tom Cruises or for men back then it would be Elizabeth Taylor and whoever else. For John, it was always Brigitte Bardot.
Oh.
So I'm not in that. I definitely am not in that realm, you know. So it never dawned on me because of that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's interesting. You must have known that he had an attraction to you.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Was he flirtatious?
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I really didn't. And that's why I never paid attention. I was too busy working. I was so in love with work that was, I was getting, to me, it was fulfilling for me. I was in the recording studio. I was getting stuff done. There were times that, I was working 13 to 16 hours a day. I would come home and just collapse and then get up and go back to work. And, you know, going out with someone that wasn't even in there. Didn't even dawn on me.
Yeah.
And most of my friends who worked with me back in those days knew that. They never saw me. I used to get a postcard that goes, one of these days, maybe you'll come out and play. And, you know,
yeah.
I was just too busy.
Afterwards, you know, subsequent to this, did you fall in love with John Lennon?
You know what? And the only reason, to make it perfectly clear, the only reason I ended up going out with John was because John himself started to pursue me, not because Yoko actually asked me. And I wouldn't do it. And that was the thing. And I was not going for it. In fact, if it wasn't for John coming after me, I would have probably either left or said, no, there's no way it was happening. That was it. I wasn't interested. I know that's where the misconception, this is the myth, that everybody thought that she said and I went and it didn't go that way.
Well, once it did happen,
yes.
Did you fall in love with him?
Oh, absolutely. It's over time, not immediately. I was still, you know, walking on, you know, needles and pins because I'm going, I'm not sure where this is going.
Was there any discussion about him leaving Yoko and you?
Oh,
and
yeah,
him?
There was, yes. In 1974, we came back and Yoko had asked and said, you know, maybe we should get a divorce, and he said yes.
And what was your thought? This is good. We could get married, and we could.
I took each day as it came. I never looked at everything as, you know, as a permanent thing. I just remembered him coming back and saying, "I'll be a free man in 6 months." I said, "What?" You know. So it was one of those. And there's another misconception. John and I lived. You know, they always use that word, and I hate it. They said a mistress. A mistress is somebody in hiding. I'm not in hiding. So John and I lived together on the east side. We had our own apartment.
How long did you live with him?
We lived together a little over a year and a half, somewhere between a year and a half, two. But our own apartment we had in New York was probably about a year or so.
Mm.
Yeah. We had to find an apartment. We were in LA, we came back, we were in hotels, we were in my small little he actually lived in my little studio apartment.
What was
and
he,
nobody knew it was him.
What was
and
he
then
like?
When somebody did discover it, we had to leave.
What was he like to live with? Was he difficult to live with?
No, he was easy. Very easy. Absolutely. When we had our apartment, one of our first early visitors was Paul and Linda.
Huh.
They came by.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they came by, and what had happened, we had when we got the apartment, we had a little balcony, and we faced the East River, which John loved. He would have the chairs out there because it reminded him of the Mersey, reminded him of Liverpool.
When was the last time, and I asked you this about Alan Klein, more importantly, when was the last time you saw John Lennon?
The last time I saw John was probably between, around the time between 78 and 79, just around there, just around the holidays, just around that time period. And then the last time I spoke to him, he called me from South Africa in Memorial Weekend of 1980.
And when was the last time, or you know, for that matter, are you still in touch with Yoko Ono?
No, I have no relationship with her. I have a relationship with Cynthia Lennon, his first wife.
Yeah.
I have a very close relationship with her, and I have a close relationship with Julian Lennon. The reason being that, you know, when I was there, it was the first time he was able to see his son in about 3 years. And I guess an opening for Cynthia and John to get closure of their own relationship, because once he left, I don't think he ever talked to Cynthia again. So they gave... There was now closure to that, and he established at that point a new relationship with his son, who he hadn't seen in a while. So it was good because Julian kept coming over. We enjoyed. We went to Disneyland, Disney World. We've been, you know, we went swimming.
This is Julian, you know, as a young child.
As a young child at that time, he was like 10 years old, and we had fun. And you know, and a lot of these pictures are in my book called Instamatic Karma that I put out a couple of years ago, and it's my photos from our time together.
Where were you when you heard John Lennon was shot and killed?
I was near. It was ironic, but I happened to be at a friend's house, and she said to me, "I'm going to make you dinner," and I said, "Fine." And she lived on the Upper West Side, right near the Dakota. And I said, okay. And then this news came over the radio. And I was thinking, am I hearing something? Is this a joke? And I'm trying to dial my friend in. As I'm dialing and we're talking, it was then announced that he had passed away. And I was like, oh, my God. And I left there. And I came running home. And I said to the taxi driver, please don't pass by, you know, the Dakota. Can we go in a different direction? He says, why? I said, John Lennon just got shot. And they said, and it was just like in disbelief. So by the time I got home, the phones were ringing, and I was getting calls from England. And they said, give me the number. And this was Ringo's executive secretary. And I said, Joan, I said, she goes, give me the number of the hospital. I said, forget it, it's over. I said, he's dead. And she goes, and she just screamed. She goes, what's wrong with your bloody country? She said, I got to go wake up everybody. I got to go tell everyone now.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It was horrible night. And then I called up David Bowie, because we used to hang out with him as well. And David's assistant, and I woke her up, and she said, she goes, are you by yourself? And I said, why? She says, I want you down here. She goes, don't. I'll find David. He's on a date. I'm going to find him. You should not be alone.
Did you go to the memorial service, the funeral? I mean,
I don't think there was one.
Yeah.
I don't think there was one. So.
I guess other than fans creating their
own. No. Yeah, other than fans. No, I don't think there was one.
May Pang, I could speak to you for hours, and actually, we should do a part two. Do you have a website where people can keep up on what you're doing?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, and you know, if anybody wants to buy the book, I mean, if they can't find it, they can find it on my website. It's called Instamatic Karma, and my website is called maypang.com. I've been working on jewelry. You know what? I would love to do this type of thing, you know, do seminars and you know, be a speaker at colleges, because now I realize that they have a lot of those music. I did one for Berklee College of Music, because you know, they had a John Lennon course, songwriting course. And it's funny because I'm really a part of that whole production. A lot of people didn't realize I really did all the production, and it's my voice that's on that song, Number 9 Dream. It's me whispering and me singing background with
no
John.
No kidding. Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
So
what a spot in history. What a unique spot in history, and it's a fascinating story, and you're wonderful. And everyone, please buy Instamatic Karma. It's been out for years. From what I understand, it's wonderful. It's just a wonderful book. And again, your website one more time, Maypang.
It's Maypang, MAYPANG.com.
May, it's been a pleasure having you, and would love to have a part two and part three and part four. May, thank you very much. Our special guest today has been Maypang from the world of the Beatles and the world of the music industry. Wonderful guest, and we'll see you next time on Turning Point.
Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by Out of the Box Studios in Bohemia, New York. Executive producers, Frank McKay, Harry Oates, and Bart Pellegrino. Director of Operations, Corey Arnold. Segment producer and talent coordinator, Kristen McKay. Audio and studio engineers, Francis Kaczmarek and Tom Shazan. Studio support, Mark Harwood, Pete Galgano, Brian Hunt, Danielle Altabrando, Keith Withers, and Chris Luna. Sound mixing and mastering, Daniel Joseph. Hotel accommodations provided by Ohika Castle Hotel and Estate in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Mark of Elegance Limousine in Hop Hop, New York. Catering services provided by Windows on the Lake in Ronkonkoma, New York.